Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley welcoming you to the 48th episode of Criterion Reflections, the podcast where we're going through the entire Criterion collection in chronological order. I'm here to talk about a film with a couple of good friends and frequent contributors, people I've worked with over the past several years, talking about these movies in ways that hopefully engage your interest and stimulate your thoughts, and as the title implies, your reflections. We recorded this podcast on the evening of Thursday, March 14th, which I believe was just mere hours before yet another terrible mass shooting down in New Zealand, targeting worshippers in a Islamic mosque in the city of Christchurch. And since the subject matter of this discussion has to do with people who left their native land in search of something new, something different, something better than the conditions and limitations that perhaps staying where they were had imposed upon them, I just really wanted to just take a minute to reflect and to show and indicate my support and solidarity with people who today find themselves in situations much different than what I live in, where I'm very comfortable living in my hometown, having seen a bit of the world and decided to come back and grow up where my roots planted me. Obviously, this episode may be listened to at other points in time where current events, like the one I'm just referring to now, don't really connect quite as vividly. But I guess I just want to make this expression just for the sake of humanity, and to indicate my deep and abiding sympathy and even identification with those who yearn for freedom and liberty and the love of family and the strength of a community, wherever they may find it. I grieve the loss and the terror that so many must live under because of the just the brutal hatred that expresses itself so violently all too often in this world. So some somber, sobering thoughts perhaps to get things started, but I just felt I had to say that as we get into a discussion which has its moments of levity, but also does have its moments of pondering and understanding the plight and the dilemma depicted in this very powerful film. So I guess I'll let my words speak for themselves and welcome you again to our conversation. And I hope you find it enlightening. Peace. Okay, well, I am here with a couple of good, longtime, and frequent contributors to this podcast, although they have never appeared with me at the same time before. So let's get the introductions underway. First of all, Josh, you've been a pretty regular featured voice here on the Season 3 of Criterion Reflections. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on tonight to talk about The Emigrants.
Excellent. Yeah, now you're down in Portland way, is that correct?
Yeah. I came down for the Nonprofit Technology Conference. I was actually at the same conference last year in New Orleans, where when we recorded a conversation on Gods of the Plague with Jason Beamish. So our recording schedule just happens to coincide with the conference.
Well, I really appreciate you fitting us into your travel plans there. Now, course, Portland is the home of Ryan Gallagher. And I think you guys made a little bit of an online connection. Have you guys actually arranged a meetup, or is that going to work out this time?
I don't think it's going to work out this time. But yeah, I'd love to meet up with other Portland cinephiles. I am checking out a couple of films at the Portland Film Festival while I'm here. And that's been a lot of fun to sample the local theater scene.
Yeah, kind of heading south from your usual Seattle stomping grounds there. I know you do a pretty major Seattle Film Festival coverage, so you get to see what the neighbors got going on. And I'll just give a little plug to Josh Brunsting. He did a nice little synopsis, 10 films to check out at the Portland International Film Festival on Criterion Cast. So yeah, good on you both. I hope you enjoy these films and also your time in Portland. And then joining us for his first appearance here in season 3, but a longtime collaborator, good friend, and partner in podcasting, Trevor Barrett. Hello, Trevor.
Hey, David. Hey, Josh.
Hey.
It's so good to be here.
Yeah, it's definitely great to get the both of you together again. You know, Josh has kind of been kind of one of my right-hand sidekicks here. And, of course, Trevor, you and I go way back to the Eclipse Viewer. Not quite as frequent here on Reflections, but we do things on Criterion Cast, and it's really great to get this combination together to talk about a film that I think the three of us all deeply admire. We'll see what the official takes are once we start talking. But Trevor, it's been a little bit since we've connected online here, so anything you got going on, any interesting projects or business you want to kind of share with the listeners?
Boy, it has been busy, busy, busy lately. I think I've made you suffer a little bit because of that, David.
Oh, no, that's fine. You know, we were going to record this a little while ago, maybe a week, 10 days or so, but,
yeah,
you know, life interrupted, things happen, and that gave us a very good opportunity for me and Robert Taylor to have a pretty timely conversation about Wanda, which is, of this recording date, not quite yet released by the Criterion Collection, but it is coming up soon, and I think it's a film that's going to make an impact.
But yeah, things have been really good. It's just, I wish I had more time for things that I used to do more. The kids are growing up, you know, busy things at work. I'm turning 40 this year, and I'm telling myself that my 40s will be a decade where I get to, you know, slow down a little bit again after the very busy 30s, you know, with kids growing up, establishing career. Can I rely on that promise to myself, David, or am I just deluding myself?
Know, your boys are getting into, like, what, middle school, high school era age?
Not quite high school, but middle school, yes.
Yeah, middle school. Well, I think the pace is just going to keep picking up, my friends. So hang in there. But yeah, squeeze in the contemplative leisure time activities where you can. You know, you got a great gift for that. And but family duties and professional responsibilities
and all
that stuff. Yeah,
I'm hoping they're getting old enough to enjoy some of these with me.
Yeah,
that'll be the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think on that topic, I think we are talking about a pretty suitable family film. I mean, it definitely has its earthy moments, but we are here to talk about Jan Troell's The Emigrants, which is the first half of a two-part epic, or you could even say the first two parts of a four-part epic. You know, these are almost like, you know, this is a quadrilogy in some ways, because these are both three-hour-plus films that could easily be broken down into two 90-minute-ish sections. And we're going to just talk about The Emigrants today, because we are in that chronological scheme, of course. We will get to The New Land, a 1972 release, in its original run in season 4. Should the good Lord and his providence allow us to have that conversation, I guess, to get into the character of some of our immigrant participants in this story and the saga that Jan Troell weaves for us. Josh, let me just hear, what's your kind of opening take, and what's your engagement with this film consisted of? Have you seen it before, or is this a first time watch for you?
Yeah, I saw it, I think, last year or the year before. Yeah, I think it was 2 years ago I saw it, and I actually saw both of these right after watching The Tree of Wooden Clogs, so I ended up with this peasant-farmer trilogy all really long, and I have to say, I absolutely love the immigrants. Mm-hmm. I am bowled over by it. When I signed up to be on this episode, I was a little daunted about rewatching it again because it is a long film. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that revisiting it, it is so magnificent. Mm-hmm. It was one of those really beautiful discoveries for me. One of the reasons I love the Criterion Collection. I hadn't heard of it before, and to get to see this real masterwork, it was such a treat.
Excellent. Well, that's a very good opening take, Trevor. How about your response to this film?
Yeah, so I had never seen it until it was released on Criterion, and was fortunate enough to get a review copy and reviewed it on my site. And just one of those that sticks into my mind, you know, as many of these as have come out, you know, we're getting close to 1,000. This is just one that I think back on, remember the day that it arrived and that beautiful cover, and just being so excited to dig into it. And then it being something I could never have expected. I find the film so unique. You know, yes, it's a story of a family. It's kind of an epic saga. But Troll's way of telling this story is so impressionistic and so just different from what I'm used to in these kinds of stories that it really stands out. And I think it's all the more beautiful because of it. I think he's chosen something that isn't just unique and therefore cool because it's unique. It's unique and all the better able to tell this human story of this family. And it's one of those films that it's kind of become a personal film in a way, because it made me start to think back on my own ancestors differently, because Troll does such a good job of making these people feel alive and showing us their little moments of their life. Not just, oh, here they are crossing the sea and look at all the drama. You know, here's a death. Look at that drama. Here's this and look at that drama. You know, it's the beautiful moments of swinging together, or that some of the terrifying moments that are dealt with sickness, but it isn't weighed down in the way that some epics are. It's very lovely and enjoyable and sad and melancholy, and just, yeah, I love it.
Well, great. Well, I think we're going to be singing in three-part harmony here tonight because, you know, I have really just enjoyed. I've been enraptured really by this revisit. I've watched this film on a couple different occasions. We watched it as well. My wife and I both enjoyed it quite a bit. This is the kind of Criterion film that she can, without reservations, get into. It's reality based. It's grounded. It's beautiful. It's challenging. It's there is a bit of a task involved in sitting down for watching a 3-hour, or even if you will, the whole thing, a 6-hour plus epic. But it does fly by, and I hear kind of what you were saying there, Josh. You know, the revisit, really, you're recapturing these moments, and just marveling at the beauty and the gravity of it all. I mean, this isn't just a kind of a glossy, you know, poetic, romanticized vision of our old pioneer forefathers and all of that. It's a very earthy, you know, gritty, down-to-earth film of just those rough and sometimes entrancing moments. I mean, it's the whole texture and beauty of life on this big canvas, capturing a story that is historic and impressive and sweeping, and kind of a generational saga that, whatever your ancestry, wherever you came from, I think there's a lot to connect with in this film, because of the way Troell tells his story. But yeah, so I've really enjoyed this last week or so, kind of transitioning, as I have been, from the world of kind of a poor working class woman, Wanda, a 20th century peasant of a sort, although probably without the work ethic that we see on display here. but you know, again, the plight of poor people. Again, Josh, you talked about the Tree of Wooden Clogs and this one, and you're kind of in this really rustic, almost primitive type of environment or this headspace that these films put you in. These are stories of the struggling, hard-pressed working class and their variable responses to it. And I also like the fact that this is more than just a family epic. This isn't, you know, the prelude to Little House on the Prairie. There's a whole community that emigrates. And so maybe I'll just take a minute to do a little synopsis here as a kind of a recap of what the film's about. As the title says, this is the emigrants. And I think the difference between emigrant and immigrant is pointed here, because this is a story told from a European point of view, obviously Swedish in this particular case, about the people who left Europe. A lot of times we here in the USA see these stories about the immigrants, the people who came to where we are to pursue the American dream and all those ideals. But you know, the story itself, and I'll talk a little bit about Wilhelm Moberg later on, maybe as we, you know, wind down the film conversation. But the story is about what those folks who left Sweden and Europe behind were up to, and what drove them to that really kind of gamble of their lives to see if they would really make it, and what were they getting away from, and what were they hoping to arrive to, and what did they actually discover when they got there. So this is the story of a group of people from Småland. It's a very rural, and even to this day, kind of a rustic outskirts of Sweden, a smallish country. But you know, these are the people who farmed very rocky soil. They earned a very hard living, and there just weren't those kind of prospects. And so the story here is really of that very first wave, at least in Sweden, of people who said, enough's enough, we're getting out of here. Who were the ones who chose to stay behind? Who were those who left? And what drove them there? And that's really what we're getting in this first part of the saga here. And in fact, the very first half of The Emigrants really is that process of coming to that moment of decision. And we see it through some very striking and memorable characters. And then the second half is that journey across the ocean. Of course, you cannot walk from Sweden to North America, although one of the characters, for a moment at least, wonders if there's a possibility. And then the trek from the harbor of the East Coast up to the Minnesota homestead, when they finally get to carve their notch in the tree and kind of depict the scene that is captured on that beautiful front cover. So who wants to kind of jump into sort of picking apart or pointing out some of the key moments? So how do we want to start unpacking this immigrant voyage?
I can maybe give some of my overall praise about the way that the film is put together, if that would be suitable for now.
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So, and I also, here's another bit of a question. I hope you don't mind if I look at some books just briefly.
Yeah.
So one of my favorite books is a book called Stoner by John Williams. Don't know if you guys have heard of it. If not, I would recommend it.
I have, but it probably reminds me of my 1970s high school days, all things aside.
I know, it's a very strange title. The cover, though, is of a scholarly man with glasses on, so it'd be hard to mistake it. But anyway, the way that book begins is it's about a professor at a college, and he's dead when the book begins. And it talks about people coming upon his name in, books about, here's who used to teach here. Here's a name on a plaque or something like that. And it talks about a student who comes and maybe wonders who he is, just idly. And then it says, Stoner's colleagues, who held him in no particular esteem when he was alive, speak of him rarely now. To the older ones, his name is a reminder of the end that awaits them all. And to the younger ones, it is merely a sound which evokes no sense of the past and no identity with which they can associate themselves or their careers. And it's that last part that relates so much to the immigrants to me. These younger people, you know, these younger professors who can't imagine death, can't imagine the past particularly well. And so the name there, this real person, is just printed script on a page. There's no sense of the past and no identity. And for me, The Immigrants does such a good job throughout of presenting us with a whole host of characters. I mean, we do have Carl Oscar and his wife as kind of the central family unit here. Mm-hmm. But there are so many other characters who come into that community that is having a hard time in Sweden and starts to look at better days ahead, even though they know it's going to be terribly difficult to get to their end goal. And it might not even be something they themselves really get to enjoy. I mean, it's a very selfless voyage for the betterment of posterity in many ways. But, you know, I think of my ancestors who did something similar. They settled out here in the West. I'm from Idaho. And growing up, they were just names, you know, some of them on headstones and some of them, I didn't even know where their headstones were. I just remember names, you know, in books where here's your great-grandparents, here are their parents. And that meant nothing to me, nothing at all. Mm-hmm. And this, again, I kind of mentioned this when I was praising the movie at the beginning, gives so much sense of identity because of those small moments. This is the way that Troll tells this story, is having us see Christina out on a swing, enjoying a moment, a very familiar moment. You know, all of us have had that moment. And then some guilt when her mother-in-law just happens to look in on her disapprovingly, as if she doesn't know how to work. And that's really the only part that we get of that. But the movie is so filled with those that we get a very good sense of these people in relatable snippets that are gorgeously filmed and beautifully acted. And it really does lend a tangible quality to these people in their past that and our own past that makes me respect and love them and feel deeply for them and acknowledge that they lived second by second of their own lives as well, you know, with fears and joys and mundane moments. All of this without being boring at all. I mean, it's so well told from that, that this little snippet by snippet, and oftentimes to the elision of the dramatic. I mean, I love that Carl Oscar is all of a sudden married, you know, and then all of a sudden they have kids. But it fits. We can fill in those blanks of the drop. We know what that looks like, but it's the little times when you see that she's so nervous that maybe they're having too many children. You know, that this is not sustainable, and the strain that puts on their marriage when basically she's kind of like, we should not have sex ever again. And she means it, you know, because it's so terrifying. We feel that weight. And the whole, I don't know, I mean, just in general, I kind of feel, even before breaking it apart into the little episodes, it's worth just kind of looking at this strong sense of identity that Troll manages here. And to be honest, I can't think of another film like these that does such a good job. I mean, even his debut, I can't even think.
Here's Your Life.
Oh, right. Yeah, it's got similar qualities to it, but it's just not done as well as this one, you know, or as these two parts are. But man, again, that sense of identity and sense of the past and the magnitude of it all, I could never imagine it working if someone came to me and said, here's how I'm going to tell this story, but it does.
Your discussion of the snippets, Trevor, it really makes me think about the fact that this is such an intimate film. It's such a, for the scope and the sweep, and, you know, we've been describing it in terms of it being an epic, but it is so profoundly intimate. I feel like through those moments, we really and truly get to know Carl Oscar and Christina and Robert. We get to know Ulrika and Daniel and everyone in this, all of these central characters. We get to know them. We get to know their jealousies, their joys. We get to know the things that bring them happiness and delight, the things that pain them. It's just such a... It feels like we've been welcomed into their family, and that we're getting a chance to really, really understand and see who they are. I think that has as much to do with the performances, the really, really extraordinary performances, as it does with the subtlety of Troll's camera work. As he drifts from an actor and pans over to a small detail, we get the sense that we're observing the things that the characters are observing. We're seeing this world through their eyes, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful film on those terms. So that when we do encounter the struggles, when we do encounter the hardships, it makes it that much harder for us as an audience. And when we get those triumphs, when we get that moment at the end, it is so joyous and such a beautiful moment. I think that it all comes down to the way Troll shoots it and the real masterclass in acting that we get, especially from Max von Sydow and Liv Ullmann in this.
And it is. It's remarkable to see, you know, those two names you just dropped, as well as some very significant supporting cast members. Obviously, most familiar to, I would say, the great majority of our listeners from the films of Ingmar Bergman. Of course, Troell is another Swedish filmmaker. Maybe, you know, well, certainly does not reach quite the majestic heights in terms of his influence and his reputation, but... clearly a superb craftsman. He is not just the director, but he co-wrote the screenplay and does the cinematography and does the editing. So everything you see on screen is really his very personal creation, and the assurance of his hand in depicting these scenes, the way certain scenes just kind of fade into those, as we said, snippets, those kind of poignant little epiphanies of all different sorts. The warm glow of family life, the working and toil in the fields, the beauty of a small house church fellowship, and even though they're doing this in a way that makes them outlaws, the communion service and the gathering of little misfits and outcasts and troublemakers. There's just so many really powerful vignettes that are, I think, once you've kind of been entranced by this film, so wonderful to re-experience and to fall a little bit deeper into that world, which was not a comfortable world. Which was not a world, I would say, that a lot of us would seek to live in if we certainly had a choice. But these people, ancestors of a sense, of us all, people who, you know, sort of stepped out of the routines and fate that kind of a certain form of European caste system had in store for them, they broke the rules. They took a huge chance, and in many cases they paid a very significant price. And yet, how can you not almost stand in awe of the kind of gauntlet that they ran to arrive at this new land? So yeah, let's just talk a little bit about let's talk about the performances. Max von Sydow and Liv Ullmann are both, you know, very handsome, almost aristocratic figures. They at least have the capacity of coming across as very suave and urbane and beautiful, and in a way, you know, they're almost well, I don't know. They're almost too refined for the rough peasant characters that they're portraying, especially if you've kind of come into contact with the source material. And I've spent some time reading the original novel. I don't want to talk about that right now, but I think their star power and the empathy and the pathos that they're capable of generating, and tapping into that kind of more rugged, earthy side of their own stories is pretty powerful and pretty remarkable. I think they do create an attraction and an interest in the viewers of kind of connecting with the lives of these very humble, basic, down-home people. Who's the guy who plays Daniel, the outlaw preacher? He was also the character from Winter Light.
It's Alan Edvall.
Alan Edvall, yeah, and I just couldn't help but meditate on the little sort of theological strains of his character in Winter Light, and then his role as the outlaw preacher. This guy just seems to know how to stir up the theological controversy in his performances. But I think that's a very key role, the descent from the state church, and the confident assurance that he has even when the forces of the law come down to break up his little fellowship. These are very fascinating stories to think about what drove people from the comforts of their native land to seek a new opportunity and a different life, laboring perhaps under some delusions or almost spiritual arrogance in some ways, and yet it propelled them into a destiny that they would have never reached if they just played it safe and stayed at home.
Your mentioning of that, it makes me think of the three different reasons really that were given by the major characters mm-hmm. for why the characters are leaving. We have Carl Oscar and Christina who are leaving because there's just no way for them to eke out a living. Their land consistently fails them. The weather is either too cold or too hot, or lightning strikes the barn and burns it to the ground. Mm-hmm. There is no way for them to really do more than subsist. And they go to America for the promise that they can build a better life.
Well, you know, and Carl Oscar I just want to kind of follow up on that. You know, he is the irreverent one. He's the one who kind of questions the conventional wisdom that, you know, you're just supposed to accept your lot in life and this is God's providence for you. And, of course, Christina is the one who's kind of towing that line.
Yeah.
She's chastising Carl Oscar and kind of keeping him on the straight and narrow until tragedy strikes and their oldest daughter, father's little companion and the apple of her mother's eye, driven by hunger, does something that has a tragic consequence. And that sort of tips the balance as well, because all of a sudden staying safe at home is not a guarantee that, that the Lord in his wisdom may not spare you from life's most mm-hmm. painful tragedies. And go ahead.
Even that moment where she goes and takes that unfermented rice and eats too much of it, it mm-hmm. is by hunger, but it's mm-hmm. also just that childish trait.
Yes, yes.
I want more, you know, and there it is. Yeah. She's sneaking it. I mean, mm-hmm. it would be so reductive, I guess. And I'm not saying you were reductive, David.
It's all those angles.
Yeah, there's so much, mm-hmm. and you see it all in the way that she approaches it. You know, she feels a little guilty, but, you know, you're a kid, you got to do that kind of thing, and there's the sure. tragedy that ensues. I mean, it feels so familiar.
Yeah, little things that can go horribly, horribly wrong with life-changing consequences.
Yeah, and when you live that close to the edge, those little choices that we make can be disastrous, can shatter mm-hmm. any you can shatter your world.
Yeah, and I let's talk a little bit about Daniel and his little fellowship. There's Ulrika, the you know, scandalous whore of the village, who really has some incredible moments when she's confronted by men or women who kind of view her from askance. She's a fiery woman who knows how to defend herself and takes no prisoners. If you really want to mix it up with her again, you know, I've known women like that, or people who are on the, you know, they're on the skids as far as their social reputation is concerning. That they've got a survival mentality, a fierceness about them that sort of, in its own way, declares truth with righteous anger and indignation, even though, you know, by the conventional morality of things, they really have no leg to stand on, and yet they are in touch with, you know, with some powerful realities that are easily glossed over by the more pious and conventional among us. So again, the genuineness, the authenticity of these characters, even the young kids, Robert and Arvid, the young farmhands and their naivete and their simplicity, kind of mixing it up with Ulrika's daughter, the young teenage girl. You get a little bit of the, you know, the adolescence. It's certainly not a, you know, it's not a gauzy teen romance thing, but you get some of that fumbling awkwardness. It's just an amazing microcosm of society and of humanity and all those different stages that we go through as these characters are really, you know, living through very extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah, and I think that something that's interesting to me in Robert and Arvid's story is you have these two young men who have gone to work as farmhands on another farm for a wealthier
basically
landowner.
Indentured servants, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And the abuse that they suffer at the hands of their master is mm-hmm. is really horrific, and it's that that really propels both of them to leave, mm-hmm. to escape for something better. And you see that naivete that we were talking about earlier. Robert has been reading this book about America, and he knows all there is to know about it. And in America, everyone has everything they could ever want.
Yes.
And it is, you know, he's trying to learn. He's trying to go beyond where he is, and he has this ambition and this drive and this desire. And it is that thing that gets them out, but it also is so foolish and naive and yeah. Mm-hmm. and really charming at the same time.
Right, yeah, he's bookish, he's a daydreamer, he's an idler and a loafer, but he is literate. He is the guy, he's the kid, really, who can pick up these books and read stories to people who probably would have a much harder time picking letters and words off the page. But he's got these big ideas, and really he is one of the engines that drives this whole plot, even though he's just a teenage boy. But you're right, that kind of institutionalized abuse, if you will, the fact that your father's going to sell you off to some oafish, drunken brute of a man who takes out his fury and frustration at his, after being henpecked and browbeaten by his wife, he takes it out on the young guys working for him. And that's the way of the world. That's a rite of passage that young men are just expected to put up with. And then when they get old and surly enough, they can start boxing their own farmhands on the ears, and the cycle of life goes on. I really feel like this is, you know, kind of depicting this historic rupture where, you know, this society was beginning to fragment, and not just Sweden, but certainly many other European, cultures were splitting off, as now there were these new options available. This film, I guess we should also say, is set in like 1849, 1850, so it's pre-Civil War America. There are some interesting little moments. They're not harbored upon, or they're not really drawn out in any extended way, but you see slaves in shackles on the steamboat once they get to America, and you're recognizing this is a portrait of a, you know, of a fairly primitive American society as well. So yeah. There's just so many really, you know, tantalizing situations, and we probably could, you know, fill the podcast on just picking apart scenes here and there, and I certainly don't have any problem doing that because there's just a lot of really thought-provoking stuff going on here. So I'll kind of yield the floor to anybody else who wants to follow up on that.
Well, maybe not so much on that.
That's fine. Take it in another.
But it is something that you had mentioned earlier that I wanted to follow up on, which was kind of the. You know, Max von Sydow and Lee Volman as actors who are kind of larger than life in a way, and how well they do in this film. And we've talked about this a little bit before, David. I don't know if you remember, but it's kind of the trend in the U.S. film industry, that it's glamour that kind of feeds stardom and who your kind of big actors and actresses are. And we did it in the context of Japanese films where they were so much more willing, it seems, to allow themselves to look, not glamorous, you know? And I do think that both of them do that in these pictures. I'm actually looking at my blog review right now, and the picture that I have of Max von Sydow, you know, he looks anything but glamorous. He's got this moppy hair and just kind of looking, the next one of Lee Volman, you know, she looks gaunt, you know, their beauty is kind of there. But their pull, the compelling nature of their, what they're doing here is not just charm and glamour and that kind of attraction. They've got so many different levels where they can pull us in, throughout these pictures. Well, I know it's hard not to say these pictures and talk about the New Land too, but throughout The Emigrants, you know, I'm thinking of the boat scenes and things like that. I mean, they put themselves in situations where you wouldn't want anyone to see you there. Even as an actor or an actress, you know, these are still, and I guess Robert, the intimacy that you were talking about, Josh, they're so intimate that's uncomfortable because they're in their moments of discomfort of their bodies aren't beautiful, glamorous objects at that moment. They're human and meat and dying or diseased, right. and they portray that on their faces and with their skin throughout The Emigrants.
Yeah, Lee Volman is recoiling in horror as she recognizes her body is crawling with lice. She's bleeding profusely from the nose, and you wonder if she's really going to make it. I mean, certainly the first viewing through, it's just like, oh my God, are they really going to kill her off? Because it really felt that suspense that, wow, this may just be one more tragedy. Is that
it was Carl possible. Oscar's,
it felt like she was truly on the brink there. But again, it's not... It's you don't feel them wringing the crying towel of melodrama. You know, they're not. There's no syrupy swelling of strings to say, ah, she came so close, but she's been saved. I mean, there is soundtrack music, but I think it's very intelligently and tastefully used, not to, you know, steer our emotions, but to, you know, mark certain passages. And you know, to bring a little bit of that accompaniment, but this is just an extremely tactful, non-manipulative film. There may have been some reviewers, or there may be even some viewers now who this is not exactly to their taste. So I'm not going to say this is going to be a across the board crowd pleaser. Like I say, it is long. There are portions that feel slow, but I have no complaints whatsoever. I just understand that maybe some people, some viewers, you know, may have their reservations about a film that that asks this much of them. I think the original American cut was even 2.5 hours, so maybe 45 minutes or so that were edited out. And Vincent Canby, in his 1972 review in the New York Times, felt it was a little bit overblown. But sorry, Vincent, you're wrong.
Well, and I think that also goes to the fact that, you know, I've heard it said that a short movie can feel really long if it's not right, and a long movie can fly by. And honestly, I don't know what 45 minutes you would cut out of this. There is nothing that I would want to see gone, because I want to walk beside these characters. I want to walk with them on their journey. And, you know, I love the fact that Troll takes so long to get us to the point where they leave, that we actually have to sit there and understand why it was so important for them to leave their homes, why they would risk everything.
And yet how painful it is. Yeah. I mean, what about that shot of them rolling the wagon away from the old homestead with the parents standing there, his old crippled father and mother. And you absolutely know this is a one-way trip, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just another day in the life. And when it comes right down to it, you're just going to get in the wagon and roll out through the gate, except this time you're not coming back. I mean, the finality of that, you know, it might as well be a funeral procession that they're watching as their son and wife and grandchildren roll out down the driveway, you know? And it's just because Troell takes his time in setting this up, you feel the weight of that as much as a 3-hour movie can allow you to really inhabit that moment, feel that emotion, and sort of let it resonate through you before you move on to the next thing.
And I really like your point, David, about the fact that this is not melodrama. This is the type of film that could easily go into melodrama or could easily go into your classic Hollywood epic. But because of the restraint, because of just the full living embodiment of these actors, because of the elisions and the storytelling, it feels honest, it feels authentic, it feels real, it feels lived in. It feels like we're looking into a window into another time.
Yeah. It feels like you're really back in 1849, 1850. Even the technology, these rustic peasant folk seeing the ocean for the first time, getting onto a sailing ship, landing in the, whether it's New York or Baltimore, wherever it is, they landed on the East Coast there. When that train first comes down the track, for some reason, you just get the feeling like, what in the world is that thing? Are we supposed to actually climb into that and ride it? You know, that there is this sense of vividness and newness and and even a little bit of terror at, like, we're going to put our children in this belching iron horse thing. You know, how is this really going to work? And that whole journey that they're embarked upon across the country, it's a complex process to get where they don't even know where they're going, but they're just looking for that open patch of land, and they're accompanied by all these sweaty, you know, ornery fellow travelers as well, who are all looking for their same slice of that promise, of that new future, that unscripted destiny that awaits them. And to me, really just captures my imagination and reminds me of even when I was a kid, first understanding about the pioneers and thinking about what it would have been like to just leave your home and head in, you know, to a covered wagon and head out into wide open land and decide we're going to just live somewhere else. We don't even know where, but we're just going to find a spot, settle down, build a house there. It's just kind of an amazing thought, even though in so many ways it's a very common and often told tale.
Well, and speaking of feeling like you're there, the first time I watched this, I had to turn off the movie during the boat sequence because it made me sick. I mean, I really thought I was going to be seasick. Yeah. It was so, and not just the motion, but it was so claustrophobic. For some reason, it just felt the weight of tepid air and disease and the close quarters and the stench, which I can't even smell, but can only, you know, it feels like it's coming through the TV somehow. It was so uncomfortable. Not in a bad way, meaning, oh, this is unbearable, I need to turn it off. But in such an evocative way, I mean, I did have to turn it off, but was very excited to turn it back on and keep up with the experience. But
just had to catch a little fresh air.
Kind of, I go outside and
reground
put my feet on the ground. Yeah.
It's so immersive. The vibrancy of the colors and the movement of the camera, just the fact that you don't know where the camera is going to go next. We don't know where it's going to pan next. We don't know what snatches of conversation we're going to hear. It really does feel like we're just a fly on the wall.
Yeah, I mean, most of the film is shot at pretty close range, but there are a few times where he backs it up and sort of steps back and, you know, kind of takes in the panorama of a situation. But again, yeah, just the confidence of where Troell puts his camera, how he frames the scenes, how he edits. It really is incredibly impressive and makes me really want to seek out more of his work. I have to think this has to be the pinnacle of his achievements, but boy, if there's better stuff out there. I mean, I have seen the other Criterion release, Everlasting Moments, which I think was kind of a mid-2000s film.
Yeah.
Well after he'd kind of matured, and I think presumably had a pretty full career of films between these two, Emigrants in the New Land and Everlasting Moments. But I do wonder, did he ever approach this type of scale or, you know, this kind of subject matter? I mean, Everlasting Moments is a bit of a throwback story to the kind of the dawn of photography, or at least the photography where, you know, simple folk, you know, townspeople could have access to their own cameras, which is, it's a story about a woman who has a gift for photography in a society that doesn't think women should be practicing that particular discipline. So he does seem to have a sort of a retroactive eye towards the past, but it certainly makes me eager to see more of his work, even if it never quite gets to this sublime level.
Yeah.
So, Trevor, I had a question for you as a guy who is pretty familiar with a lot of, you know, foreign literature and literature translation. Have you encountered any of the work of Wilhelm Moberg, or does he have a reputation in your literary aficionado circles at all?
Not in my circles, but, you know, maybe we're all just equally ignorant in my circle.
I
know he's big enough that in Minnesota they have Carl Oscar Days, and Carl Oscar is not a real person, you know. It's strictly because of these books.
I actually have purchased The Emigrants in a Kindle version. I had a little kind of Amazon gift point, so I thought, okay, I'll just take a shot at it. And I have completely enjoyed the kind of pairing of watching and reading the source material. Mm-hmm. And so I'll say this, is that Moberg's writing style is very direct, very plain spoken, but very illuminating. He has an obvious affectionate warmth for these characters, but he also has kind of an ironic, droll, slightly subversive wit. You know, he knows how to sort of poke fun at these folks, and because the way he writes gets you into the kind of interior lives of these characters, even more so than this very well executed film can, it really brings these characters to greater life. So I give a strong recommendation if you really want to, you know, get the most pleasure out of watching this film, at least get The Emigrants. I'm halfway through where I'm reading, they've just gotten into the sea voyage, but if you really want to lay the foundation for what motivates these characters and the daily lives that they led, Moberg's books, which were written in the, I think he started the series in the late 1940s and maybe finished them up either the late 1950s or even early 1960s. There's a four, it's a four-part series of novels. I think it may have just been the first two that were adapted into these films, because I think they take Carl Oscar's character until he's like 90 years old or something like that. So you certainly don't get all of that in these two films. But they were extremely popular in Sweden, and he was considered pretty much, I guess, the most, you know, at least most popular, influential Swedish author of the 20th century, at least according to some of the write-ups that I've read. I don't know, Trevor, let me just ask you about that. Swedish literature, is there other, are there other names from that era, you know, mid-20th century, that would kind of rank up there in terms of critical reputations and all of that?
You know, I feel like the main things that I hear about are just the ones who've happened to also win Sweden's big literary award with the Nobel Prize. So you got Sigrid Undset, mm-hmm. And several of them who won closer to the beginning of the 20th century. But okay. But yeah, you know, I don't think it's because of any like lack. My circle tends to favor. I guess more Latin America, and if mm-hmm. if it is European, it tends to be Eastern European literature that tends to take up a lot of my time and interest, sure. You know, Hungarian and such. So there very well could be larger circles that where it's like, who is this guy? You know, what is he talking about?
Does
he
know
Wilhelm Moberg? You know, mm-hmm. But it doesn't look like a lot of his books have been translated into English. You know, it's got the Immigrant series and then four other novels. I was a little surprised, I guess, to hear how popular he was that he maybe didn't win the Nobel Prize, because, you know, again, that's a Swedish prize, and while they are trying to make it worldwide, they don't hesitate to award their own mm-hmm. when it's time, you know, when yeah. someone's kind of making a big splash. So I'm curious now. I don't know a lot, and again, a lot of it could be just the things I've never looked into it or registered with it. But yeah, this is kind of an open area there, a blind spot, I guess, of my own that I. Now you've kind of stoked my interest.
Yeah, I really feel like, you know, he is writing probably for a mass audience in a good way. I mean, these are very accessible. They read very quickly. You're not, you know, not having to scratch your head. He's not flashing you with his awesome literary techniques, or, you know, kind of getting you wondering, what is it I just read, and having to think too hard about it. But there is a warmth and a wit that I really enjoyed. And again, just getting a little bit deeper into the characters. Troell, like I said, was a very faithful adapter. A lot of the vignettes and a lot of the scenes and even quotes are very directly lifted from the novel. There's a few things he left out, but really mostly, you know, background stuff or a few side, you know, character incidents. But all the main characters from the novel are here in the film. And like I said, I haven't really gotten into the, you know, journey through America side of it yet. But I feel like it's a very complimentary. So whether you read the novel first and then watch the movie, or I'm sure most of us will watch the movie. And then, if we choose to get back to the literary source, it's illuminating and I'd say very rewarding. So I kind of give that high recommendation there.
Just typing in with Wilhelm Moberg and you know, kind of other 20th century Swedish authors, there are several that I've just kind of stumbled upon who were famous in the 20th century for their accounts of working class life. They're Eivind mm-hmm. Jonsson, Ivar Lo Johansson, Arthur Lundqvist, Harry Martinson, Jan Fidegaard, Moa Martinson, and Elin Wagner, and then it has Moberg, and I've never heard of any of them. So okay. There's definitely a big area there, and in fact, it even is talking about Wagner, that Elin Wagner, that they are very they kind of paved the way for Swedish feminist fiction. So a rich, rich area there to explore for anyone who, like me, just has never looked.
Yeah, I think Moberg, actually, when he saw Here Is Your Life, which is Troell's debut feature, he actually sought out Troell to say, yeah, he's the guy who I want to make movies out of these books. So I guess this was a property that was being marketed, and I think they were very popular in Sweden. And I believe, was this the one? One of these two films was nominated for an Academy Award.
Both of them were, actually.
Both of them were. So this one was
in 2 years. I think it was Best Foreign Picture in 71, 72, and then Best Picture in 72 or 73, whichever, you know, on subsequent years it was up for Oscars, very interestingly. Yeah.
Carl Oscars. No, just plain old Oscar. So it does seem like this film, at least, you know, within the Hollywood awards giving community, it found an audience. It connected. It did seem to vanish into obscurity for some period of time. Maybe it was just not easily available. Maybe it wasn't redistributed throughout the 70s, so people kind of lost track of it. But I think, like you guys both said, this was kind of an unknown discovery. I think, yeah, Here Is Your Life had come out by the time that this was announced. This is, what, a 2016 release? Yes, 2016. Yeah. And I think it's been pretty well received. But I really feel like, you know, even the good words that we've given it tonight, just be prepared to be, you know, quite impressed. I think most people will say this is a really accomplished and memorable piece of work. Any other particular moments or aspects of the film that you guys want to bring to the forefront before we start winding down a little bit?
Yeah, there's one thing that I've been thinking about. That second section as they make their way across America, mm-hmm. and we start to see how the Americans themselves view the Swedish. And I found that really, really fascinating. Mm-hmm. You know, Carl Oscar early on, he buys a nice pair of boots because he doesn't want to, he wants to impress the Americans. He throws out all their rags on the boat because we can't be seen wearing this while we're in a new country. What will the Americans think of us? And yet, for all that, the Americans really do look down on them. They view them as less than, and it makes me think about the things that are going on in our own culture right now.
Absolutely.
I think we forget so quickly how poorly we as a nation have always treated the immigrants. And always treated those people who we believe are infringing, or we think they're mm-hmm. they're less educated. We think they're less than us. And I just think it was a really shocking reminder, because it doesn't dwell on it. The film doesn't make a big deal about it, but it's there.
Everything that happens in this film is just like, well, to quote the other title, Here Is Your Life, you know?
Yeah.
It is what it is. It's a matter of fact. It's an unflinching portrayal of life as it happens, without the sentimentality, and yet with all the emotional heft and impact, and just, you know, the pain, the agony, the ecstasy. I mean, however you want to put it, you know, the death of young children, the parting of ways of dear loved ones, the putting up with the persecution of those who you left behind because and the book maybe brings this out a little bit more, is that these emigrants really were seen as, you know, violating God's will. They had to deal with every kind of guilt trip and emotional manipulation and how dare you do this by the powers that be in the old country, thinking they're going to a land where there's no hierarchy, where everybody's able to achieve for themselves, and if you work hard enough, you'll get you know, your due reward, or at least you'll have the opportunity to do so without the overlay of of old authorities and expectations. And yet when you get there, well, you know what, there's still the upper class of the steamship and the lower class.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's the first class passenger train, and then there's the cattle car that the rest of you all have to ride in. And so even those naive hopes are dashed as they encounter people who really aren't that much different from themselves, or maybe not even a generation, but a matter of years ahead of them getting off the boat. But now they're looked down upon by their peers, their fellow emigrants, pioneers, or maybe people who whose parents made that journey, you know, a couple decades earlier, and now they're the objects of scorn. So you're right, and I appreciate you bringing that to the forefront, because I had those same applications to current events and mindsets that somehow feel like those people coming from that place over there have no business coming to our country, you know. And yet this is also a very old tale that goes way back even before the founding of the USA. But
yeah,
obviously the United States of America, because of its unique history and place on the globe and all of the things that have happened, does have this legacy, and yet we seem very incapable sometimes of recognizing that those same forces that drove our beloved ancestors to bail out and head on over, those things are happening in other countries today, and we've got to really have some compassion for the same crushing oppression and hardship and daring and the bravado, you know, the gutsiness of people who are willing to make that fateful decision. You got to respect that, and I'd like to pray that we could be welcoming and compassionate to people who are truly desperate and have little else than their wits to fall back on.
Well, you both very eloquently talked on that point, and I just need to say I agree. So it doesn't sound like I'm some silent dissenter over here, like, oh, I'm not going to get into this one. Because I'd actually, you know, that's kind of a bit of the film that does strike me every time, but it also kind of flows away. Like you said, David, here's your life, and it just is, without making a big point of it. But it's true, you know, these people aren't showing up just out of greed and naivete. There's a bravery, there is a sacrifice and a willingness and a complete disorientation. Their lives get shattered in more ways than one, because of the sacrifices, because of the sufferings that they had that led them to do this anyway, the sacrifices they made in order to make the trip, the unintentional sacrifices from the trip itself, and then the new land, you know, this new place that they have no part in yet, has to be some place that can sympathize and empathize and help, rather than one who just continues to push down because, hey, here's some element that I can push down on. You know, it's so sad. And I that's never the part of the film that stands out the most, but it is a very important part of the film that definitely has so much resonance today.
You know, just playing on my monitor as we talk here is the scene where the emigrants are kind of moving across the country, and they come across this one kindly American who feeds them these nice juicy slices of pork.
Yeah.
And every one of their faces is like, we have entered the promised land, as they have that nice little meaty chop dished out to them on the plate, and this sense of arrival, and somehow that sacrifice was worth it, and our sacrifice, our endurance has met this very succulent, momentary, ephemeral reward of just a nice chewy mouthful of roast, you know, but boy, is that good.
Yeah.
I don't know, just it's just one of many, many moments where you can just really extract a lot of meaning, a lot of significance from just a little depiction of humans being human. It's really remarkable.
So are we all about guys, to start part two now of the episode?
well, we will get there, but you know, I sometimes this chronological scheme is a rigorous, locked in. I won't call it a prison, but I'll just say it's a discipline, and so we have to hold ourselves back. Delayed gratification, let's call it that. We do have other great films between now and then. Before we get to the full inhabitation of the new land. But I hope you guys can join me when we get to that point in season four, and we'll pick it right up where we left off. So, yeah any final comments? Again, this has been a fun discussion. If it feels like we're just kind of scratching the surface. We're maybe giving our listeners a chance to check this one out, an encouragement to go revisit it, or if you've just watched it and want to hear what we have to say, whether it's now or somewhere down the road. I hope you've enjoyed the chat that we've created for you about this really remarkable, wonderful, and all too human film.
I do wonder, David, since you're really digging into everything chronologically, how does this feel to you when you put it up next to and side by side some of these other films from the 70s?
Yeah, well, you know, it does feel a little bit, well, I don't know if it feels out of place or not. It's, you know, I kind of made the connection to Wanda as far as its kind of working class, poor folks subject matter. This is not some rowdy, hell-raising New Hollywood type of iconoclastic film. And yet, I don't know, there is an iconoclastic element to it because he is making this historic epic in a way that I don't think Hollywood was really capable of making this type of film. The plaintiveness of it, the restraint of saying, we're not going to, give you these, saccharine moments. We're not going to give you some musical follies type of entertainment. Even the love stories or the romance angles are very understated. They just feel very natural rather than kind of heightened in that way that kind of reminds you of this spoon-fed narrative the heroic element is more implied than kind of pressed right in front of you, So to me, maybe there were other directors that were doing work of this sort, but the scale of the film, the fact that they, had the courage to say, let's do a 3-hour, plus telling of this tale. Again, the American distributors decided they needed to cut it down a bit. But Troell's vision, which thankfully Criterion got a hold of and restored and gives it to us in its full unedited glory, that in itself seems like a fairly courageous decision and presentation. So it's got a very, to me, feels like a very contemporary look. I mean, it's a very handsome film. The lighting and the colors, we've already talked about that, but it's very sumptuously produced. The production values and the inhabited reality of it is just really, really remarkable. You don't feel like they cheated or compromised anything. That's like they dug up, suitcases and wagons and things. If they weren't authentic period pieces, they really made sure to use the very primitive or basic technology to recreate the dress, the garments. I mean, just it feels almost so thoroughly realized that you never feel like this is a bunch of 20th century people pretending to be 19th century folk.
But definitely not Straw Dogs or all these,
Yeah, right.
One of the ones I've got coming up.
It's down the road. We've got Jacques Tati's Trafic. We've got Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, and a few others. So it's going to be an interesting exploration as we get into different styles of filmmaking here. But this is not a film that's trying to shatter taboos, let's say, you know. but nonetheless, I think it's a very challenging adult film that the kids can watch as well and learn. I mean, this really would be a very appropriate educational film. You might have to break it up into shorter segments for, you know, a classroom type of presentation. But man, if you really want to get a look at what it might have been like to be a pioneer settler, I can't think of any films that I would put ahead of this one to say this is as close as we're going to get to how it really was.
Yeah. Yeah, that your remarks about it, while it doesn't necessarily shatter the taboos that some of the other films in this decade were, it does play with form and it plays with style in some really, really interesting ways. So thank you for placing it in that context.
Yeah, one other little connection I'll make with Wanda, the one we talked about, I mentioned it in that episode, there's a film called The Pioneer Experience that Barbara Loden directed and starred in from 1975. So this was after Wanda. It's only a half an hour, and it's about the life of a Kansas prairie family in like 1869, so about two decades roughly after this film was set. It's also pretty good. It's a much humbler little production than this one is here. But, you know, that's a very fascinating. I've just kind of made that mental connection as right now in our conversation there. So I think this represents the films of 1971 quite admirably. And, it's probably one of my very favorite films that was produced that year. And I think that will probably hold its very high status as we move further into the catalog. All right, guys, well, it seems like we've come down to wrap-up time, so thank you very much. Trevor, you want to give little shout-outs for connections? How are you doing over at the Mooks and the Gripes? You still posting stuff over there frequently?
Yeah, it has been tough the last week or two is all. You know, but for me, that is kind of a long period of not posting. But as far as movie stuff, was it today or yesterday? In the mail, I got The Kid Brother and Detour to review.
Okay, so those will be coming out pretty soon.
So I'll be putting those reviews up within the next few weeks. And you know, there, speaking of international books and such, there's the Man Booker Prize or the Man Booker International Prize. Long list came out on Monday evening here, but you know, basically midnight in London, and that features a whole lot of books from around the world. Encourage people to look into that, and I'll be covering with help from many people most of the books that are on that long list. So you know, the interest stays there. Like as
book reviews. Okay, fantastic. I will look forward to digging into some of that. I'm always on the lookout for some good supplemental reading material, so we'll see what your recommendations have in store. Josh, what kind of online activity have you been up to?
Yeah, you know, I finished up my Oscar stuff, and so I'm working on a piece about my favorite film discoveries of last year. So the Criterion stuff that I dig through and discover for the first time. And then also on my blog, I've been started a new column this year, kind of collecting all the different art house offerings in Western Washington, because we have some really neat theaters that are playing some really great stuff. And so I just wanted to have a way for me to know what was playing in the area so I didn't miss important screenings. And that's been a lot of fun. And it's been fun to connect with some of those local art house theaters in our area.
Yeah. It's been an interesting mix. You've got a nice blend of repertory, kind of, you know, classic stuff coming back around, as well as the newer art house production. So even though I'm a couple thousand miles or so away, I do appreciate kind of keeping tabs on what's showing up your way. So thank you for keeping that archive up there and keeping us informed of what's happening out there in the Great Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
So as from our respective, West Coast mountain time zones and Great Lakes regions, the sons of immigrants ourselves, we bid you a fond farewell. Thank you for listening, everybody. Look forward to your feedback and comments on this episode and all the great films we discuss here at Criterion Reflection. So like I said earlier, we'll be back with Jacques Tati's Trafic next up in episode, was it 48, 49? I'll figure it out when I do the editing there. But anyways, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to y'all soon. Goodbye.